Okay, so welcome to week 9 of Ripped from the Headlines, despite what the title says, because that's, although I managed to change the name on my own file, they didn't actually change it on the title of the sheet, so that's what you end up with. This week we're going to talk about a couple of articles that are, on the one hand, new news, on the other hand, old news. Both of these have been going on for quite some time, but they do represent very interesting both halachic discussions and analyses from the sources. The first one is about what seems to have been happening a lot recently, is woman dies after getting trapped inside Toronto clothing donation bin. If you hadn't heard this on the news, a lot of people had. Actually, somebody mentioned it to me, and that's how I got it. Is that it seems that in a number of places across Canada, but even across the world, the large clothing donation bins that you see around for various charities actually have, you know, some sort of mechanism that stops people from getting inside of them. And sometimes can happen that if someone does try to get inside of them, for whatever the reason may be, to put clothing in, to take clothing out, they can get stuck and injured. And here's what happened in this particular case. A woman is dead after getting partially trapped inside a clothing donation bin in the city's West End. Toronto police were called to Bloor Street and Dovercourt Road just before 2 a.m. Tuesday. The donation box is located behind an apartment building, as many of them are. It is unclear how the woman, who is in her 30s, became trapped in the bin. She was found unconscious and pronounced dead at the scene. Firefighters had to use a saw to cut a couple of metal bars that hold the front drawer of the bin in place. The design allows for items that are placed inside the tilting drawer to be dropped inside the bin. Okay, so this is what usually happens in most of those bins. You have some sort of drawer, sort of like a mailbox or a library drop box, where you can put something in, and then when you close it, everything goes down into the bin, but you can't, you know, directly reach into the bin and put things in or out, usually. Some of them, you know, some of the more advanced ones are automated as well, and they may have hydraulics or you know, other different, you know, mechanical ways of preventing theft. And people say the woman appears to have died after a medical episode, so not necessarily exactly, you know, from getting stuck there, but so the exact cause of death is not yet known. Neighbors say this new bin was dropped off last week to replace a previous one that was damaged from previous break-ins. Okay, so it is not something new that people are trying to steal clothing from this donation box. Perhaps the donation box should simply, if it wants to function as a good clothing donation box, simply leave the door open. If there's, you know, so many break-ins that people are desperate to get these clothing, it's probably not by millionaires who are looking to resell them. It may be by people in financial need and who are unfortunately resorting to having to try to steal. So anyways, this was a new bin and this woman has now died. This is the 8th death related to people getting stuck inside donation bins in Canada since 2015. That is a scary stat. 5 of these deaths were in British Columbia. Last week, one of the largest manufacturers of clothing donation bins across Canada said it is open to making changes in order to prevent similar deaths from occurring in the future. And in fact, from what I hear, some have been removed and others have been replaced. And people are working on all sorts of different ways to avoid these tragedies from happening again. Obviously, no one who's trying to donate clothing to the poor or needy wants it to end up with dead people. So this is very, very tragic. Now, there are really two discussions to be had about this case, because there are always two possibilities as to how someone can get stuck inside such a bin. They can be doing something innocent, or they can be doing something less innocent. Let's take a look at source number one. Source number one talks about the concept of a bore, which is a pit, something that has the ability to damage people that is found in different domains, and what the liability is. So the Mishnah tells us in Bava Kamma, HaChofer bar birshus hayachid, if someone digs a pit on private property, which a lot of times, I don't know the exact legality of it, and if there were, you know, some lawyers here, I'm sure they could help us out, but the boxes themselves are not public property. The boxes belong to these people, whether or not the space under them or exactly what status they hold, it seems that they are private boxes. For that reason, if you dig a pit in Rishus Hayachid, in private property, Piskol Rishus Harabim, and it opens its entrance into the public domain, which it usually does, again, unless this, you know, we'll talk about the apartment building, it may be considered a different Rishus Hayachid, but Ober Rishus Harabim, Piskol Rishus Hayachid, or if you dig a pit in the public domain where everybody can walk and it's open to a private domain, Birshus Hayachid, Piskol Rishus Hayachid, Acher Chayev, Or even if you dug it in one private domain that is adjacent to another private domain, in all these cases, you are responsible for damages that occur in it. Says the Gemara, Tanur Rabbanan is trying to figure out exactly what the case is, and which is the case that the Torah refers to when it says that someone digs a pit and something can get damaged in it, that they're responsible. So, we quote in a Braisa, Achofer Barber Shusa Yachad, Piskal Shusa Rabim, Chayev. If someone digs a pit in a private domain and is open to the public domain, which again is pretty close to what our case is, they are, again, liable in any cases where someone gets injured. Vizehu bar ha'amur b'torah, divrei Rabbi Yishmael. And this is the pit that the Torah refers to when it says if someone digs a pit and something bad happens, they're responsible. Rakiva Omer, hifkir reshusav lo hifkir boro. Zehu bar ha'amur b'torah, if you originally dug the pit in your property and then you said that all of your property was, you renounced ownership really on all of your property and except for on the pit, that's the case of the bor that said in the Torah. Okay, that's not so relevant. Amar Rabba, bibor birishus harabim kuliyama lo plegidim echayev. When there's a bor found in the public domain, which again, depending on how you view this, it may possibly be, but not 100%. Kuliyama lo plegidim echayev. Everybody will agree, both of these opinions will agree that you're chayev. My time amar krok yiftach v'chiyichre. When the Torah tells us about opening a pit and the damages associated with it, it says when a person will open the pit or when a person will dig a pit. Now ask the Gemara, Im al psicha chayev al kriya lo kol shekein. 1 second. You're telling me if I uncover a pit in the public domain, or maybe in the private domain that's accessible from a public domain, I'm going to be chayev for damages. I would think that if I dug it, I wouldn't be chayev. I wouldn't be liable for what happens. Obviously, if just uncovering it is enough to make me liable, for sure digging it is enough to make me liable. So says the Gemara, Ela she'al iske psicha ve'al iske kriya ba'alo. Okay, this is because it says the, if you want to follow along in the English here, right? He says that the interpretation of the verse must be the responsibility for the pit comes to him by engaging in opening the pit and by engaging in digging the pit. Although he does not own the area itself, he is liable for creating a public hazard. Meaning, therefore, we see even when it's not in his particular owned land. And again, we continue. Lo nachgu ela b'bor b'shuso. The argument between Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Yishmael is, which we saw in the Braisa, is only when it comes to a pit which is found in the person's private domain. Rabbi Akiva savar bar b'shuso nami chayef. Rabbi Akiva says if something's in your property, you're also liable for what happens, whereas Rabbi Yishmael says, right, and he explains this from the Pasuk, v'Rabbi Yishmael savar ba'al atakala, that he interprets the Pasuk that Rabbi Akiva quoted as proof in a different way, and Rabbi Yishmael will say that the one who digs a pit in his own property is not liable. Most likely, though, I mean, you're looking at a case of liability. It's not really a murder case, although, you know, it's hard to tell in these cases exactly what the halacha would be, and I'm not coming to paskin halacha, but certainly you see that you have to be careful when things are accessible to the public of what you are, you know, leaving open in public space, and even though, again, it may have come with good intentions, that's something to be concerned about. I mean, there's also a question to be asked, just before I'm going to get to your question in one moment, when people are sometimes doing positive things, there are people that have come to collect the clothing that are inside that can get damaged. You know, these are really serious issues and sad cases. The question actually arises about the famous phrase that Chazal tell us, Shluchei mitzvah einan nizokin. Anybody who is sent to do a mitzvah is not harmed. You know, you have people who are trying to give charity sometimes, or people trying to collect for charities who are harmed in these cases. Now, that may not be true in cases where there's, you know, a great danger, which there may very well be here. I mean, it doesn't sound like this is a safe activity based on the number of people that we see injured, but we do see that there's a certain responsibility that the party that owns the land and the party that puts it there has to take for what it's putting down. Yes?
Okay. So, excuse me for being late, so if you did this already, let me know. If a pit is something where it's on the ground,
mm-hmm.
and someone can fall into it not realizing it's there. This is a different case where it's above ground and people know that they shouldn't be, you know, going.
I mean, someone emptying clothing from it or someone putting in clothing. Here we're talking about assuming that it's an innocent case. That's what we did mention in the beginning.
I think most of it, like someone says, oh, there's a coat down there, I like it.
Yeah, and again, we're talking about the innocent case. We're going to talk about theft in one moment. Because when it comes to theft, we're going to have a very different perception. And if we're ready to move on to that, I think we will.
But I presume the person who's either donating or taking the clothing out because they work for the organization,
mm-hmm.
the person who works for the organization, I presume, has another way of accessing the clothing through the back door. They open it.
Right, and I don't know exactly what the cases are, but yes, they don't jump in, you know, they don't jump into the big drawer and then have someone close them in there and then throw it out. Like, yeah.
And as far as the safety of depositing things, I thought that that is guaranteed, that there's no issue about putting clothing in. It's only when one attempts to take it out.
So I think it's supposed to be that way. I don't know if it is.
Because has there ever been a case of someone who's deposited clothing? Like we talked about it, them doing a mitzvah and being harmed, but I think these are all.
I was thinking more a collection. I did see that one of the cases, I believe, was someone who was collecting them for the company. And that's where I was worried about that. That's where I was sort of concerned about the shluchei mitzvah aspect as well as, you know, the innocence of it. But I would assume, not wanting to cast aspersions on any one of the people that was murdered or killed, sorry. Well, it depends on how you look at this case. You know, I would assume that there are a lot of cases where people are breaking and trying to take stuff.
Yeah, that's what.
Yes.
And
if that's the case, and I did actually find something in the article that hinted to that. If you see, neighbors say this new bin was dropped off last week to replace a previous one that was damaged from previous break-ins.
Right.
Previous break-in sounds a lot like there was a break-in going on, or at least they suspect one. Yes.
To say all of these, because I've seen people do this. There are many bins around. Mm-hmm. There's a key that somebody has, and that whole front door opens and everything just pours out, all the bags and whatever. It's either at the front or at the back.
Uh-huh.
Right.
So anybody who was trying to get in was trying to take something that wasn't there, because if it was an employee or a volunteer. Right.
So I don't know that all bins are created equal.
All bins are created equal. They are the
okay. Okay, if that's the case, then the case of Bohr doesn't apply all that much, but our second case does. And for that, I brought you a fascinating story that took place. It's from Roy Bleich and Contemporary Halachic Problems. It's a story told about Rav Zilberstein, and it's quite eye-opening to read it at first. So I had to shrink the text a little bit to fit everything on. But here we go. Some time ago, an incident occurred involving a socially inept American student who became the butt of his classmates' derisive behavior. Matters reached the point at which one of the tormentors regularly invaded the oppressed student's knapsack, stole the sandwich the latter had prepared for lunch, and proceeded to eat it himself. This is unfortunately not so uncommon, I would assume. Endeavors to enlist the aid of fellow classmates in order to identify the thief or to prevail upon him to put an end to the practice were of no avail. Finally, the victim, who excelled academically as a chemistry student, took matters into his own hands.
I'm sure you excelled as a chemistry student, so.
And proceeded one day to lace his sandwich with a poison. For those of you who you know, can't see it on the recording, that was me saying, I don't know. In the midst of an afternoon lecture, one of the members of the class became violently ill. Shocking. In the course of the ensuing tumult, the victimized student revealed that what he had done, explaining that he had resorted to poisoning the sandwich in order to establish the identity of the thief. Thereupon, the rightful owner of the sandwich administered an already prepared antidote. This is such a crazy story. To counter the effect of what otherwise would have been a lethal poison. The students involved seem to have been non-Jews. Okay, now, that's the end of the story. However, many years later, a Jewish student who witnessed that episode and who in the interim had become a physician in Israel as well as a participant in a periodic seminar conducted on behalf of physicians by Rav Yitzchak Zilberstein of Bnei Brak asked Rav Zilberstein if the aggrieved student's conduct would justify it in accordance with Jewish law. So what would you think he would say?
Yes.
Of course not. That's what you would think, right? Clearly, Linda is on a different wavelength than the rest of us. Surprisingly, as reported in the Israeli Torah Journal, Pa'amei Yaakov number 44, published in the Torah Journal, no less, Rabbi Zilberstein immediately responded, not only is it permissible, the matter even involves a mitzvah.
So there.
In a one-line statement published in the Kislev 5760 issue of Pa'amei Yaakov, the following one, I guess, in this one, Rav Chaim Kanievsky gives a qualified endorsement to that position. Rav Kanievsky writes, it appears that there is a basis for the words of my mother-in-law, for my brother-in-law. Rav Kanievsky wrote, Rav Kanievsky wrote that it's yesh makom, meaning there, you know, it's certainly a possibility that there is a basis for such a thing, not that he necessarily 100% agrees, but certainly that it's valid. Later, as reported by Rabbi Elisha Mann, Derech Sicha, of Bnei Brak, Rabbi Kanin, that sefer, Rabbi Rabbi Kanievsky asserted that his opinion with regard to the case of the poison sandwich was solicited by Rabbi Zilberstein, and that he responded that the student was fully justified in poisoning the sandwich. So there we go. Rabbi Kanievsky's statement is presented in conjunction with his reply to a similar inquiry. A thief gained entrance to an upper story of a dwelling by means of a rope. In order to prevent repeated burglary, maybe the owner of the house replace the rope with a weaker one that will snap and cause the burglar to fall and injure himself. Rabbi Kanievsky responded in the affirmative. Okay, now, the same issue of Pame Yaakov, as well as the following issue, number 45, contain a series of critiques of Rabbi Zilberstein's ruling, authored by Rav Sina Meir Frankel of Yavniel, Rav Gedalia Axelrod of Haifa, Rav Mordechai Blinov of France, Rav Yaakov Gernirer of Nebrak, and Rav Nasha Klein of Brooklyn, as well as two responses by Rabbi Zilberstein. A further critique by Rabbi Gedalia Rabinowitz of Jerusalem appears in the America Torah Journal or Yisrael, volume 6, number 2. Okay, Rabbi Zilberstein's view is also published in an article appended to Chacham Levi Kach Mitzvot, authored by Rabbi Lezer Roth and from Bnei Brak, and appears as well in his Chashuki Chamed Vava Kama 387 and his Tarat Chashashuai number 34. Okay, so this was a subject, as you can imagine, of a lot of debate, and the people opposing Rabbi Zilberstein are also significant, both in number and in stature. Some of these are very big gedolim as well. So now, this is a cool case, but until now it's quite theoretical. Discussions attributed to Rabbi Zilberstein of less dangerous methods of identifying and apprehending a miscreant are published in these and these places. Okay. Although the rather bizarre fact pattern on discussion is unlikely to be replicated, the issues involved do have practical application in more usual situations. A classic example is the question of whether a householder who has reason to fear that his unoccupied premises may be burgled may booby-trap his house in order to protect his property by maiming or killing the miscreant. The crux of Rabbi Zilberstein's position is that a person may do as he pleases in his own home, with his own knapsack, or with his own sandwich. The thief or trespasser proceeds at his own risk. Consistent with this reasoning, it follows that a person may store bleach or chlorine in a whiskey bottle and need not be concerned lest a burglar read the label and consume the contents, believing that the bottle contains whiskey. Indeed, Rabbi Zilberstein asserts that such a course of action is justified even if the householder is aware of the fact that the would-be burglar has designs upon his whiskey. So this is the story that happened. Now, if this were to be the case, that when someone tries to steal from these, you know, sort of donation boxes, that, you know, they may sometimes become injured or killed, this would be a very relevant case. And in fact, you know, especially if you're going to go so far as to say, you know, it's good that people should get what's coming to them, in a sense, which we'll talk about in a couple of sources here. Really, I mean, that's really the way he puts it. I'm not endorsing any view over the other as of right now, but you will hear the discussion back and forth in the next couple of sources. But really, you know, if we're talking about on purpose trying to do something in first place, but if this is something that's just really happening to happen, that sometimes when people try to break into these things, they can sustain injuries or death, I would see no strong impetus to immediately replace all of the bins and stop this from happening if that's really something that's okay. It could be that it's just okay and isn't really a mitzvah. It could be that it's actually something which is bad, in which case, in these cases of bins, we have to look and say, okay, you know, is there some way we can avoid this? The other question would be, you know, to put up big signs on bins, you know, danger of death if you steal clothes from here, as proven with the following, you know, 8 news articles from the last 4 years. But this is something that I figured we could look into a little bit more and would have very strong applications to what we're talking about. And here I'm going to actually just present 2 different sources, and we'll try to discuss them as best as we can. I didn't put down a lot of the later sources that analyze each of these sort of earlier or primary sources in the discussion for the sake of keeping the discussion open. The first case which Rav Zilberstein brings to support himself is a case in Baba Kama, where the Gemara tells us the following. Again, you're welcome to read the English or the Hebrew along with me. I'll try to follow along in both. The Mishnah teaches us, okay, Hichnis perasav lechatzar balabayis, if he brought his produce into the homeowner's courtyard without permission, so someone else brings their own stuff into the other person's yard without permission, and what happened is the owner's animal was injured by the produce, he is liable. Okay, so if I take my apples and I bring them into your backyard and your animal gets injured by my apples, then I am responsible for the damage caused to your animal. Okay, Amar Rav. We're actually going to see that that's not the only factor here. Of course, that's important. Yes, that it's, you know, you're going to someone else's yard, but that's not the only factor here.
The damaging item.
In their yard, yes. But here, listen to what we're going to say now. Amar Rav, Rav says, Lo Shanu. this halacha was taught only in which case? Ella shehuch lekapahen, where the animal tripped over them and fell down and broke its leg, or whatever it was doing, right? And the animal slipped on it and fell. However, aval achla patur. But if it ate from the produce and was injured, he's exempt. My time, asked the Gemara, what could be the rationale for that? Says the Gemara, a shocking, shocking statement, but again, one that's very relevant to our case. Havala shelo tochal, says the Gemara. The animal shouldn't have eaten the other guy's fruit. The animal shouldn't have eaten it. It was not the owner of the fruit who acted improperly, but the animal himself. The animal itself. The animal shouldn't have eaten it. And in this case, the person who put the food there, he put his stuff in someone else's property, and the animal gets injured from it, but it was only through eating? The guy's off the hook. Why the animal shouldn't have eaten it? You can look back at the animal and say, you're lost, buddy. It wasn't your food. You shouldn't have eaten it.
I guess if the owner had fed the animal properly, maybe he wouldn't have eaten it.
It's nothing to do with the owner. It's just simply, we don't have to assign blame to the person who put them there. It's not his fault. We can assign blame to something else. Now, we're going to see. You're not off scot-free. Yes.
But that's what animals do when there's a... As opposed to a person who's not supposed to steal the bin. So,
You have an issue with the Gemara, is what you're saying. Okay, well, I mean, we'll talk about it. We're going to continue the Gemara. The Gemara is not done yet. Yes.
I agree, the Gemara. Because it's natural for an animal to eat. So it's a natural thing. Animal sees an apple, he eats it. However, if the animal tripped on the apple and fell, then it's not the animal's fault. Because the thing was there and the animal just didn't look down. He looks up.
Okay? Right.
So that's exactly... This is put. The animal is acting according to the way the animal acts.
Right, but despite the fact that the animal is acting according to the way it does, the Gemara still says that we can assign some bit of blame to the animal, not that we're blaming the animal and saying your fault, but at the very least the person is off the hook.
That's right.
Because just because what they did, they perhaps they didn't expect that to happen exactly. The point is that they're not fully at fault when the animal does something that we could say, you know what, technically, the person could counter by saying, I didn't want you to eat my apples. I think that's sort of the crux of the Gemara here, although this Gemara is a little bit tough right now. Let's continue with the Gemara.
But the guy's off the hook.
Is legally off the hook. We're going to see that in one moment. Wait. Okay. We're going to see. This is not absolute. Okay. Amar Rav Sheshes. Rav Sheshes said, Amina kinayim v'shachiv rav amar lahashmaitza. A very funny phrase which comes up a lot in the Gemara, unfortunately. This was Rav speaking. Rav Sheshet says, I say that Rav stated this halacha while dozing and lying down, meaning while he's sleeping, and it's not precise, as it is taught in the Braita, the following thing, right? Titania, as we learned in the Braita, Hanosin sam hamaves lifnei behemas chavero pater midine adam echaya vidine shamayim. If one places poison in front of another's animal, he is exempt from human law, but chaya v'dinei shamayim, liable according to the laws of heaven. So if you put down a poison, let's say you put down rat poison in front of your friend's pet rat, and the rat eats it, you're off the hook from paying damage to your friend, but God will get you later. Okay, that is the what this brisa says. Now, what can we infer from this? So says the Gemara, sam hamaves hud lo avida da'achla. From the above statement, it can be inferred that specifically where he put poison in front of the animal that he's exempt, since poison is not something that's usually eaten. Okay, we're getting right back to your point now. Normally, we'd expect it has a big skull and crossbones on it. Even an animal, you wouldn't expect it. Some regular animal food that an animal gets, it's poison. But you know what? Says Rav Sheshes, in opposition to Rav, Aval peros de avida de achla bidine ani adam nami mechayev. Says Rav Sheshes, but if you put produce before it, which the animal regularly eats, of course he's going to be liable according to human law. It's only if you put poison, which is not usually eaten by the animal, and the animal might actually, you know something's up, that's when you're going to be off the hook. But if you put real food in front of it, and it eats it, and it gets a stomach ache, or they were laced with poison, or you poisoned your sandwich, then you do have to pay for damages that are caused to the animal. So the Gemara now... It says, and this is why it's a question on Rav, V'amai, why is that the case? Havyaleh shelo tochal. It shouldn't have eaten these fruits, asked the Gemara, meaning a question on Rav. So, Amri hu hadin afilu peros nami patzer. So how would Rav answer this question? It seems that we have an inference from this brisa to say that if you put actual food in front of it, you would have to pay. Yet he says that you don't have to pay, so he could answer in two ways. So he's saying, Huadina filo peros nami patri midine adam, vekamashlan da filo samaves nami glavida dachla chaya vidine shamayim. So one possibility is, okay, this price in order to explain Rav's statement, the sages said, and again, I'm trying to follow the English and the Hebrew here, although it may be better if I explain this outside as well. The same is true that even if the animal was injured by eating the produce, he would also be exempt according to human laws, which is Rav's statement. And this brisa teaches us that even in the case of poison, which is not suitable for eating, the one who places the poison before the animal is liable according to the laws of heaven. Meaning it's not coming to, we shouldn't infer from it that you have an upper level when it comes to putting food in front of it, but rather even with poison, which is not edible, you're still going to be liable, midine shamayim, from the heavenly court. The other possibility, the Gemara says, is v'bayis ema, if you want, you could say, samhamaves nami be'afrazta dehainu peri. Or you could say, samhamaves, poison, refers not to a jar of poison or something that's not edible, but some sort of plant. Okay? It's an item suitable for eating as well, such as afrazta, a type of herb that appears edible for animals, but is actually poisonous. So that would be how Rav would explain this. So we have basically two opinions of the Gemara. One is that if you put it in front of it, and it eats, which is Rav Sheshes' opinion, so long as that's food, you're liable even for Dine Adam, you're legally responsible. Or we have Rav's opinion, which the Gemara goes to great lengths to basically defend and say that, no, in fact, we can explain Rav in one of two ways. The person in the case where you put food in an animal, in a case where you put food in front of it and it ate, the person, according to Rav, would be liable only midine shamayim, it's not an only, but it's still an only, but would be exempt from human law. So Rav Zilberstein says, well, if it happens with an animal, and the Gemara goes through to defend Rav from the question of Rabbi Sheshes, we see that Rav's opinion is held in high regard, and that one will be exempt from human law when he puts this in front of an animal, for sure with a person, you'd expect him not to be taking the other guy's sandwich. So that's it. So of course you're going to be exempt. Why is it a mitzvah? You know, that we're not going to get into today. But he would say it's totally appropriate for this to happen. You see, you're off the hook with an animal, so too with a person.
Wasn't this entrapment, though? He did it purposely. He laced his sandwich to catch the guy, so he knew he was going to take the sandwich.
Okay, so that is an excellent response, and that really is one of the major points that everybody disagrees about in this case. Rav Zilberstein would say, and he does say, he says the Torah says, lo tignov, don't steal, or lo sigzol, lo tignovu, whichever pasuk you want to use. It is aser to steal. Therefore, you shouldn't steal a sandwich. If you're stealing a sandwich, you're already, ignoring what God had to say on the matter. And if it's poisoned, well, it's not entrapment because you shouldn't have been taking a sandwich. You shouldn't have been taking a sandwich yesterday and you shouldn't be taking it tomorrow. And that's what he countered was strong enough warning. Most other people seem to disagree and say, no. You know the guy's going to do it. You know the animal's going to do it. That's not great. Also, of a point of contention on this is the matter of Dine Shamayim. If, in fact, for the animal, and you're saying that that's equivalent to the person as well, there is a punishment from the heavenly court, sound like it's still not a nice thing to do, certainly you shouldn't be doing that with people. And it's different because this is in the person's own property, or Zilberstein would say, it's not where you put the food in someone else's property, and there's no trespassing issue. All of these are valid points, but this is one of the sources under discussion. Some will say, look, you can see that it's, there clearly is a burden of responsibility upon the person putting it there, even if it's in their own property, because you know that some outcome is going to take place. And that's something very dangerous to do in terms of the person's health, but also in terms of halacha.
I wonder yes. if anybody brings up if the bullies are like a rodent.
So
he's protecting.
So the bully, I think it's kind of hard to call them a rodef. A rodef is a situation or a circumstance where we're concerned that one party is going to kill the other. Bullying is bad, but I don't think it would have the halachic status of rodef.
Right, destroying somebody's mental health, for example. I wonder if that's a rodef.
Right, so rodef may have to be immediate. I mean, exactly what the parameters of rodef are is a good question in and of itself. I don't think this particular time having his sandwich stolen, this one incident, would classify him as a rodef right at that point. There's a broader discussion that has to be had, and no one's suggesting that this is a good thing. Right. And in fact, obviously damaging, someone's mental health can cause all sorts of issues later, including, sometimes someone's life. But I don't know that.
Further to Gershwin's point about if you break in to someone, you can
excellent.
Kill them because right. they're coming to kill you.
Yes, so that is the case of Baba Machteret, right. but that's only if the case of life is in danger. That was one of the cases I was going to bring down here. I figured we could limit it to this because it's here, it's very clear. If the person stands up and guards his lunch, the bully is not going to say, I will kill you and take your sandwich. I think that's pretty clear. Again, what he's doing is a terrible thing. And again, what the bully's doing is a terrible thing. We're trying to determine if what the person in response did was justified or not, but it's certainly an interesting case.
Just
yes?
One more thought the other way. I mean, he's using this to identify. He has the cure to this poison, so no harm will be done.
Well, I mean, harm's done when, you know, you're vomiting all over the floor.
I don't know
and
how violent it was. Was it,
I would guess it's pretty violent if, you know, it's a deadly poison. Certainly the case of the burglar where someone's going to be injured, you know, a lot of these cases...
I think this was used to identify. It's almost like...
There are plenty of ways to identify someone without poisoning them.
Right. So
he could put trace... Exactly. Right? Like the fire alarm liquids.
Yeah, but
this... Okay.
Isn't intent part of this? In other words, when he took the sandwich, if he deliberately put enough poison there and he knew the guy would die,
mm-hmm.
but he didn't. He just put enough there to make him sick to identify him. Isn't an intent part of this issue as well?
Mm-hmm.
We don't know whether he wanted to kill him. And the same thing with the man who brings his fruit... And or whatever it is, and either poison, which may be camouflaged as fruit,
mm-hmm.
Did he want to kill that animal because he hated the owner, or did he just want to poison them?
That's interesting. I didn't take a look. I didn't take a look so much at that aspect of it. Intent is sometimes hard to figure out.
For sure.
And you know that's always something that we have to play a bit of a guessing game with. We can never know the person's. I didn't mean to kill him. I just ended up killing him.
Yeah.
It's another complicating factor for sure. But on the other hand, again, if this is something that's okay to do, and you're really going to say that it's fine, you know, and it's justified in protecting your stuff, again, like filling, you know, a whiskey bottle with chlorine or making a very, very weak rope so someone will fall down and break their skull, you know, even if that's their intention, it sounds like there wouldn't be an issue. Meaning that's how far these postkin were willing to go to say it's okay. Even if it was the intent to kill the person, it would be fine.
Okay, that's, so even if these guys died,
yes.
that would have been okay.
Yes.
If the sandwich dealer died, that still would have been okay.
That was the implication of what he said, yes.
Okay.
The next source that we're going to talk about to analyze in this is one that is actually really, really close to what we're talking about, but ends up actually being quite far, according to some opinions. It's from a mesechta called Derech Eretz Rabbah. It's one of these smaller mesechtos that doesn't actually appear in Shas, in the six orders of Mishnah, but, you know, is also something of early origin. Umaaseh b'Rabbi Yehoshua. It's sort of like a medrash in this case. There's a story about Rabbi Yehoshua. Shehishkim etzlo Adam, someone went to sleep at Rabbi Yehoshua's house. V'nasan lo achila ushtia, and he gave him to eat, he gave him to drink. V'ha'allahu legag lishkav, v'natal sulam mitachtav. He brought him up to the roof. To allow this person to sleep, and now in order to get up to the roof, you had to ascend on a ladder, right? You can think of it as sort of like a loft type situation, and he took away the ladder afterwards. Rabbi Yehoshua took it away with him, presumably intending to return it the following morning for the person to be able to get down. Now what happened? Ma'asa oto ha'ish, what did this man do? Amad b'chatzi ha'layla. He was, you know, in Rabbi Yehoshua's guest room, so he gets up at midnight, v'nata asakelim v'karchan b'taliso. He takes his, you know, clothing that he has with him, or his little bag that he has with him. He takes everything in the guest room, that's Rabbi Yehoshua's, wraps it up in his clothing, puts it in his bag, and decides, out he goes. Now, he hasn't realized that the ladder has been taken, obviously, so what happens? He tried to go down. Nafal min hagag v'nishbar amar pakto. He falls off the roof and he injures himself. L'shachris, the next morning, it's early in the morning, hishkim Rabbi Yehoshua. Yehoshua comes, uva matzo kishihu nofel. And he finds him there lying on the ground, you know, holding his arm or his leg or his head or whatever it is. Amar lo, he says to him, Reka, you empty person. Kach osin b'nei adam shekamoscha. This is what you dirty type of people do. I give you food, I give you drink, I give you lodging, and you try to steal my stuff. Come on. Amar lo, Rebbe, lo hayisi yodeh, shenatalta zasula mitachtayin. What's the guy's response? Rabbi, I didn't realize you took the ladder away from me. Like, this guy's a bit of a jokester, but he says, I didn't notice that you'd taken away the ladder. And therefore he thought he could get away with it. Amar lo reka, yet hayodea shemi emesh, hayinu zehirin b'cha. Do you not know that yesterday we were already being careful about you? Meaning, I knew that you were a bit of a sketchy guy when you came. And therefore, he says, I took away the ladder, so that way you wouldn't steal from me. Okay. And sort of, I just gave that away there. There's really two ways of looking at this story. One way of interpreting the story would be to say, Rabbi Yehoshua is doing exactly the poison sandwich case. It's the middle of the night. The guy's not going to know what's going on. He knows he's going to try to escape. Boom, he's going to fall down and injure himself. And Rabbi Yehoshua says, great idea. Thumbs up, guys. Let's take away the ladder so he hurts himself. Because, and if you look at the narration and the discussion back and forth, it says, you empty person, how dare you? I knew you were going to do this, right? That seems to be what the conversation's, you know, showing us. On the other hand, there are other people who look at the story and they say, no, no, no. A very different story is taking place. The assumption was that the person realized that Rabbi Yehoshua took away the ladder. He took away. No, he didn't sneak it away behind the guy's back. He brought him up to sleep. He said, good night, I'm taking the ladder with me. And the guy didn't realize. But what was the point of taking the ladder? He knows. No idiot's going to try to get off the roof without a ladder there. So therefore, he'll only be able to get down from the roof when he's supervised by Rabbi Yehoshua in the morning. The point was to deter him from doing it, not to injure him. Right? So it's the equivalent of, you know, writing a big sign on the sandwich, poisonous, don't eat. He's trying to stop him from doing it. Right?
But so he said, I didn't realize you took the ladder from me?
Yes. And so the question is, how do we interpret that part of the story? Is it that he should have assumed and he should have realized that he took the ladder away? Whether that would have meant, you know, in some way to take a light and check if the ladder was there before descending? Or that it sounds like Rabbi Yehoshua, you know, just brought him up to sleep. And he said, I'm taking the ladder, good night. And the guy says, I didn't realize that's what happened.
So he just ignored the fact that I said I'm taking away the ladder?
So we don't know if he said it, but we're assuming that it would have been visible. It would have been easy enough for him to figure out. That's one approach. The other approach is say, no, he did it in a sneaky fashion so the person wouldn't notice. Right? So anyways, it's, again, a question of how to interpret it. There's a lot of discussion to be had. I would not advise that anybody try this. There's also all sorts of legal issues that you can have, you know, if you were to try this. And I think that, you know, you'd have a tough time explaining it to both a Jewish court and a non-Jewish court if you were in any of these circumstances, despite the fact that you may have opinions from very, very great people saying that it's permitted.
So if you hold he was trying to warn him, and mm-hmm. he was actually preventing him from, trying to prevent him mm-hmm. from doing this crime, on the sandwich case, you'd almost have to say that the guy said, I'm going to find a way to identify you, so you better watch out, because I'm going to do something that's going to sort of try and catch you, to stop him from doing this any longer. Maybe he wouldn't, but he'd have to say
something. Yeah, I mean, that's the case. I mean, you want to make sure the person is properly warned before they get themselves into trouble, and even then, you probably don't want to hurt them too badly. Right. You know, people's lives is not something we just play around with as practical jokes. Despite the fact that it may be cool to booby trap someone's house, you know, so if someone, you know, gets in.
But certainly with this clothing bin case, which is how we started this whole
right.
thing, I don't think anyone's saying that the owners of the clothing bins want to catch the people red-handed.
I don't think they're trying to say they're catching them. I think they're trying to make, correct, I think they're trying to make it very, very hard for the person to steal. And if that comes at a price of death, then you know what? That's probably not such a bad thing based on some of these sources and some of the interpretations that we've seen. Now,
from a legal standpoint and what's happening, I understand they're redesigning all the bunks.
They are. That's what we mentioned. They are trying to avoid this. I mean, eight deaths is certainly more than enough, and that's just in Canada in the last few years.
Yeah.
So yes, they definitely want to redesign these to, you know, legally keep people out, but also not injure them in the process. But again, even if they would be injuring them in the process, from a halachic perspective, you could make a very strong argument to say that the bins don't have to be replaced, and, you know, thief beware. Don't go ahead and break into these boxes because you might just get injured. And you know what? That's not their problem.
And in some ways, this is very similar to the class you gave last week, which I just listened to, so it's fresh in my mind.
Okay.
About no frills putting the food out there and people eating it and getting harmed. Right? So.
Well, we didn't talk about exactly that aspect. Right, in the article, it was discussed whether or not they're responsible to put a lock on it.
Right.
But that's more like a Lifne Iver type of situation, a little bit. I mean, I guess sort of so is this. Yeah. Yeah, it is similar in some ways. Yeah. Okay, I think we'll leave this case at that. We have 15 minutes left to talk about Ontario emergency room wait time spike. I thought we were in a third world country. If you had to go to a hospital emergency room through the holidays, chances are you had a long wait to see a doctor. City News has brought you many stories of overcrowding over the past few years, and the latest numbers show it's getting worse, with more patients coming for treatment and waiting longer than ever to be treated by a doctor. Shalane Wallace saw that firsthand when she took her 18-year-old daughter to Humber River Hospital on Friday evening before Christmas. "I couldn't believe it," she said. "I thought we were in a third world country." Her daughter was born with a heart condition and was having chest pains, but Wallace said they waited almost 7 hours before seeing a doctor. "I couldn't believe it," she said. "I thought we were in a third world country." This is a, I guess, a repeated phrase. "I was appalled at what was going on, and there was basically nothing to be done. There was only one doctor. He looked helpless. There was basically over 100 people in there," she explained. "There were people standing, children from a few months old to senior citizens. We were left there just standing and waiting, and there were seniors there crying." Wallace said frustrations boiled over several times throughout the night, and even security even had to be called. A spokesperson for Amber River told City News they've had the highest volume of patients on record. Numbers from the Ministry of Health and Long-Term Care show several other GTA hospitals are also over capacity, including Arthur General, Scarborough Health Network, and Mississauga Trillium. Hospitals are under increasing pressure, with more patients arriving for treatment and more staying longer than they should because they are waiting for long-term care beds, which have 30,000 people on the wait lists. According to Health Quality Ontario, government appointed task force over the past year, patients waiting for alternate care make up the equivalent of 10 large hospitals' worth of space every single day, and emergency room visits are up over 11% over the last 6 years. Across the province, people spend an average of 16 hours in the emergency room before getting admitted. These are in cases where they're actually admitted to the hospital and not just, you know, sent out immediately. That's more than 2 hours longer than 3 years ago, making matters worse. Walk-in and urgent care clinics are often closed when emergency rooms are at their peak. Of the 21 City News reviewed, none were open after 8 p.m., and many had limited weekend hours. North York General told City News that anticipated the increase in volume over the holiday period and took extra measures. As a result, they say they did not see higher wait times compared to the rest of the year. That wasn't the case at other hospitals in GTA and across the province, and then they had responses from all of the hospitals. This brings up a very interesting issue, and the issue being as follows. Certainly in cases like this, but even in other cases, doctors are very, very important from a halachic perspective and to society at large. Shulchan Aruch tells us, source number 5, with Rabbi Torchiner's translation, if you're giving a shiur on some sort of topic relating to medical professionals, chances are Rabbi Torchiner has given at least 4 or 5 shiurim on it already. So in this case, nitna ha-Torah reshus l'rofe l'rapos. The Torah permitted a doctor to heal. U-mitzvah hi, and it is a mitzvah. U-vichlal pikuach nefesh hi. Who? And it is part of saving lives. V'im monea atzmo, and one who refrains from healing people, harei zeh shofech damim, this person is considered to be a spiller of blood. It's a very, very bad thing if you're a doctor to not see patients. This being the case, what would we say about dozens of doctors all going off on vacation to spend a couple of weeks with their families? Number one, from the perspective of, is this a good idea? Which I think we can pretty clearly say it's not a good idea, if what we're hearing here is, you know, reported as absolutely true. But on the other hand, what about a Jewish doctor? Is a Jewish doctor halachically permitted to take a vacation, never mind around Christmas time, and around when other doctors are off, but ever? Is a doctor ever allowed to take a break from seeing patients? What if they're an emergency room doctor, which we're going to talk about, that actually may have some interesting tweaks different than regular doctors? So a very interesting case study that happened was in a discussion of physician strikes by Rabbi Bleich. You know, he got a lot of sort of discussion today, both in the earlier case as well as in this case. An interesting point regarding the level of services which must be provided is reflected in a letter addressed to the medical staff of Shaarei Tzedek Hospital, signed by 2 leading rabbinic authorities and published in the Kislev 5744 issue of Asya. The signatories, Rabbi Yitzchak Yaakov Weiss and Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Orbach, report that it had come to their attention that the number of physicians available to treat patients fell below the number of physicians customarily on duty on Shabbat. Assuming that the Shabbat staff is the minimum necessary for purposes of pikuach nefesh, these authorities declared that the members of the medical staff are obligated to assure the presidents of medical personnel be not fewer in number than on the holy Sabbath days. So very interestingly, these rabbanim felt that whatever is the absolute minimum for, I guess, keeping pikuach nefesh at the smallest level that it can be, is a level that even during strikes needs to be kept up by doctors. Now, whether or not doctors can strike at all is another long discussion, but the point is they're willing to say that even in cases where they would allow doctors to get off work, right, they're acknowledging that doctors are striking, and may even permit it, that, again, that's another discussion, But they're saying in those cases, even those striking doctors have got to go back to work to hit that minimum threshold. Again, if we're really dealing with one emergency room doctor, I'm having a hard time seeing a threshold like that be met. And that would be because we need to make sure that the public has doctors available. And if someone then says, you know what, I'm going to go on vacation or I'm going to strike, perhaps that would be a halachic issue. Now, the problem is, philosophically and based on logic, what we have right now is that a doctor must always be available at all times and places for everybody that wants them. Now, there's going to be a few problems with that. Number one, you know, they can't live. You know, what did they do? Oh, they went to sleep. Someone called them on the phone. Better get up. You know, it'll be very, very hard to be a doctor. Impossible to be a doctor. And just, you'll never have any rest and peace. But there are other factors as well. So Dr. Rosner in Journal of Halachic Contemporary Society in Fall 93 writes, does that mean that physicians are obligated always to be available for their patients? This question requires additional deliberation and consultation with competent rabbinic authorities. He doesn't have a good answer to that question. Can a doctor take a vacation? Can a doctor go and eat supper if there's patients waiting in the waiting room? Can a doctor go to sleep at night? He doesn't quite have that answer.
He has a replacement.
Okay, so when there's a replacement, we're going to see how much a replacement helps. But what if there's no replacement? What if... You know, and these questions of medical ethics go way further. What about if the fact that a doctor, you know, can go to another country where there aren't so many doctors? Is the doctor, you know, obligated to do that? These questions extend far beyond it and way into general medical ethics, which I've had some fun with my students this year in the course. But these are very serious issues. But let's go back to, again, the vacation question and see how Poskim have dealt with that. So Noam Salomon, in his article in Journal of Halachic Contemporary Society, only 16 years later, he has a very, very long and comprehensive article on all sorts of topics relating to physicians, but he says the following. Thus, it would appear that if a physician denied a patient treatment, this is based on what he has, you know, added up until now. He would be violating a positive and possibly two negative biblical precepts. It is therefore understandable that Rashi explains the statement of the Talmud, the best physicians go to hell, as pertaining to a physician who has the ability to treat a destitute individual but refuses to help the patient. Okay? Meaning, because you have the command of the Torah, the mitzvah of virapo yirape, that a doctor should try to heal patients, and it's a mitzvah. You have the potential issues of lo tamor adam reacha. You have other potential issues as well, which he outlines. So he says one positive mitzvah and potentially two negative into averos from that sense. Now, this raises a number of significant questions. Can a physician take a vacation? Can he retire? Must a physician answer all calls at night and while resting? How would a patient who has the funds but refused to pay a fee be characterized? Now, here we go. Although the physician should be treating patients as much as possible, here's one important note. It should not come at the expense of the quality of care that a patient receives. The more patients a physician has, the busier he will be, and the less time will be available for each patient. One important point. Moreover, a physician who is overworked may lack the same focus that he would have if he worked fewer hours with fewer patients. The psychological needs of the physician should also be considered, because taking breaks and avoiding burnout may be necessary to ensure the best quality of care. Moreover, the busier a physician is, the increased chance that a mistake can occur. Even inadvertent mistakes are seen by many Rishonim as having some physician liability and needing reparations. Similarly, many contemporary halachic authorities consider the accidental, inappropriate injection of the wrong drug as being similar to an intentional act, because you actually did something there. Thus, an overload of patients can overburden the physician and compromise patient care, potentially leading to careless mistakes. It is plausible to suggest that setting limits on the number of patients will be beneficial for all parties. So number one, consideration number one, is if we don't give the doctors any rest, there's going to be negative repercussions to the patients, which will be violating all these issues in the other way around. Number one. Okay? Recent halachic sources highlight that in the modern developed world, it is uncommon for cities to have a shortage of physicians. Point number two, in the regular city of Toronto, I don't know that there's such a shortage of doctors. People may say there is now. You know, it's hard to get into doctors. I don't know exactly. But many places around the world, there are more than enough doctors to care for people, despite the fact that doctors can only work regular and sometimes even shortened hours. There's still enough, you know, people there to meet a certain critical threshold, whereby people are receiving the proper medical care within the appropriate amount of time to avoid unnecessary illness and death. So that's one point of it. Now, therefore, If a physician were to refuse, either passively or actively, to respond to a sick patient, there are ample other physicians who can treat that person. Thus, Rav Shlomo Eliashiv, writes that if a person is not seriously ill and not in need of urgent care, if a physician is eating, sleeping, or resting, he is not obligated to tend to a patient. So this is one psak, this is standard, and you may potentially apply that even to a vacation. Again, if it's time that the physician is saying, I need this time for me, I need this time to keep my mental health, I need this time to be able to see more people, I need the time with my family in order to live a normal life, perhaps you could say that therefore, especially with a regular physician who's not dealing with life-threatening circumstances, that would be allowed, and there would be it would be okay because there's other people who can step in their place. Obviously, if there was no one else who could step in their place, you'd have a more serious issue. Not to the point that you'd want to be that the doctor is completely sleep-deprived and can't think properly, but you would still have an issue. However, a seriously ill patient falls into a different category. The Tzitzel Yezer writes that although a physician who does not aid a seriously ill patient in a time of need may not monetarily be responsible for damages, he nevertheless has an obligation to come to the patient's aid. If he does not, he will be punished by the heavens. Okay, so on the other hand, when it comes to more serious illnesses, you can't just place, you know, the burden on someone else. If you have an obligation in a lot of these cases to heal the other person. Again, you still have to take all these other factors into consideration, you know, of how you practice. And Ishmael Avram comments that this distinction may not apply if the inactivity occurred after the physician began treating the patient. And he's referring back to the case of Rav Eliashiv, not even a seriously ill patient per se, although certainly with a seriously ill patient. It's when we say that the person is refraining from treating someone, says Ishmael Avram, this may only begin to apply once the doctor has started seeing someone or is in a position where he should be seeing people or something like that. The Talmud explains that if a person delineates that he is depending on someone, then that person is liable for any loss incurred. The Shulchan Aruch applies this law even if the statement was not specifically stated, but was implied and obvious, e.g. the implied relationship between a physician and a patient. Thus, an Ishmael Avram concludes that a physician who denies treatment to an existing patient is also liable monetarily. Consequently, it would appear that distinction is made in Jewish law regarding refusal to treat a person being dependent on the severity of the sickness and where a pre-existing physician-patient relationship has already been established. So we have really two factors, and each of these is actually going to dictate the opposite result in the case of our emergency room wait. On the one hand, emergency room doctors are quite important. And again, depending on who else is available and what the doctor needs this vacation for, you know, there are some things to be said, but on the other hand, you know, you're dealing with very seriously ill people who are coming into an emergency room in the hospital. And abdicating their responsibility is not necessarily something the Torah would look kindly upon. On the other hand, unlike a regular doctor who has set patients who are normally relying on that doctor, an emergency room doctor has not really begun to treat any particular patients that are in the emergency room. He doesn't have that prior relationship. So that might be something that you could check off in terms of, you know, more of a defense of some of these doctors. Obviously, if anybody's talking about a practical case in this, they would need to consult a Rav as to, you know, what exactly the circumstances were. But certainly based on the sound of things in these emergency rooms, many of these details that are in the article, which would, you know, provide perhaps some leniency for doctors to take off, don't seem to apply during these days. And, you know, it should be something that, first of all, society should look at and say, you know what, you know, even as a non-Jewish and just someone who would consider themselves to be moral, to maybe look at this and say, you know what, yes, it is nice for me to spend some time off on Christmas, but you know what, there are people that are waiting X number of hours in the emergency room, some of whom may be, you know, really getting injured or dying because they're not receiving fast enough treatment. That's certainly something to consider. And as a from person, you know, even more of a burden were to fall on a doctor who would be in this circumstance, that perhaps Christmas time is not the best time to take vacation, but rather afterwards, once everything gets started, then there are ample people to replace them, and, you know, they can make sure their patients are seen by someone else. That's something that is, you know,
it's
very...
It's even a Kiddush Hashem in some ways, to, you know, to fill the place with from doctors who are covering for the Gentile colleagues whose holiday it is.
So that is one aspect of it. On the other hand, if it's just a few Jewish doctors, and they are in a rush because they've got, you know, way too many patients and they are being hasty and it looks bad, you know, there's that other side of things as well.
Right.
Obviously, you want to do the best you can in any circumstance,
them,
but...
So that they can provide good normal standards. I'm just wondering, I mean, it sounds like we're talking about giving them time off so they can do their job better or they're not sort of under stress. But there's a quality of life issue as well. In other words, will people go into the profession if they know that this is, you know, this
that's
is
a very situation. Good question as well.
So
I'm not going to address that.
For becoming physicians because you're making it, you know, such a difficult way of living.
Yeah, that's certainly a consideration. I mean, in general, if you look through that article and many others on, you know, the permission and responsibility of doctors, I mean, there's even machloksim as to whether someone is, you know, whether someone would be obligated to pursue that as a career. Like, is that something that the Torah would say, well, because there are sick people, therefore you must become a doctor, you must become a doctor, you must. That's a question that comes up. Never mind, is it permissible? You know, is it obligatory?
Right.
And there may be some reasons to say that in certain circumstances. Again, we got back to some of the other questions, but what it essentially revolves around is, you know, all of these considerations being stacked up against one another and how we can balance each individual case. It's not something where you can just give, you know, sort of a general ruling, because otherwise, again, everybody takes off the same weekend and you're in big trouble.
Yeah, this isn't exactly on point, but it's similar. My understanding is there's even leniencies with respect to Shabbat and Halacha so that a doctor can go to the hospital and do their clinic and then come back on Shabbos, even though maybe they should stay till the end of Shabbos, because otherwise they may not go, and if they don't go, then
yeah, that is
so
something that's related as well.
So it's talking about quality of life that you're providing in order to. So
yep,
I don't know.
Right, and you know, in terms of better doctors, worse doctors, what each doctor adds, why the Torah has to tell us that doctors are given permission to heal, all of these are things that play a role. But this, I thought, was a sort of nice summary that he gave here in this article as to some of the different factors that would be taken into consideration when someone would be asking or receiving a psak on this. And for that, I think we will call it a night. Thank you very much.